Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the Randomly Generated History Club, where three non-historians pick a year at random and try to learn things about it. I'm Will, and I'm here with my two friends, Ant and Anna.
Hello.
Hello.
This week, we're talking about the year 1187. Mm-hmm. And do we have the three-word previews
before
we launch into it today? Please, I'd actually like to first of all start with Ant.
Okay, then mine is So Many Dynasties.
So many dynasties. So probably at least two dynasties. And Anna.
Fascinating. Mine is Sad for Yoshi.
Sad for Yoshi. Yoshi.
Yeah.
Okay. The dinosaur in Mario.
We'll see.
Okay. What about you, Will?
Just having like genuine flashbacks to playing Mario 64? On the SNES. Was this was that the one that Yoshi turned up for the first time?
You really aged yourself
there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it was. So my... Crusaders versus jihadists.
Oh, okay. I wonder what Will's going to talk about.
Yeah, exactly. Kingdom of Heaven. Yeah, you could have just said Kingdom of Heaven. That's three words.
Kingdom of Heaven.
Should we impose a penalty for saying it? The name of the movie?
Yes.
Like we used to do with Game of Thrones,
yes.
Right? Oh, and that cured us. We haven't mentioned Game of Thrones in like 40
episodes. That's true.
Yes, okay.
I'm going to slap you on increasingly painful parts of your body with every mention of it.
I agree to this. Okay, this week I'm going to talk about Balian of Ibelin, also known as Barrison the Younger.
Why do I know that name?
You know the name because he, as I'll come to in a moment, he features in the movie Kingdom of Heaven.
That's hit number one.
And he was a crusader nobleman in the Kingdom of Jerusalem in the 12th century. And of course, he's also the central figure in that movie, which is probably the greatest motion picture ever made. It was made in 2005, stars Orlando Bloom at the very, very height of his powers.
Yeah, absolute peak of his powers, I would agree.
So the peak so far.
Well, I mean, famously.
There could be a Kingdom of Heaven 2.
Yeah, until they reboot Lord of the Rings and this time he plays Gandalf.
There's so much more to come from Orlando Bloom. And also starring the incomparable Eva Green. Mm-hmm. And consider yourself warned, this contains basically nothing but spoilers. My whole bit is
Eva
just spoilers.
Green really gets typecast as like
a mysterious
adjunct woman that is just the
Mysterious adjunct woman is the best we can hope for, honestly.
That'd be amazing. I'd love to like be a mysterious adjunct, just a powerful, powerful knight. Okay. No, I'd hate that. Now I think about it. Okay, so yeah. The main event, which is the climax of the movie, is the event that took place in the year we're talking about.
Sorry, what movie is this?
1187. No, don't do it. She'll hit you more.
The movie in question, and this the year is 1187, right?
Yep.
Okay, so this was the year where Balian took command of the defences of Jerusalem and ultimately ended up surrendering the city to a chap called Saladin in October of that year. So we're going to talk a bit about Balian mostly and his life. So Balian was the son of the first Balian of Ibelin, and his dad had been given the castle of Ibelin in 1134, so was that about 50-odd years before. And that had been for his loyalty to the king of Jerusalem at the time. And this was a brand new fort that had been built between Jaffa and Ashkelon on the coast. And it was one that then obviously the family then took their name from. And Balian was basically the youngest brother of three boys that his father had. And his father was this sort of classic figure of crusading people at the time, crusading knights. So the family didn't have like that much of a name before all of this. And then he made most of all the warring opportunities and managed to make a name for himself. So he's kind of like new money, new knight. And
it's a real rich to riches story, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's like,
okay, we've already diverged from the movie because if memory serves, he's like a poor blacksmith in France, right?
That is the way the movie portrays it. So I'll come on to this. So Balian, you know, having been the youngest son, his older brother Hugh then died in around 1169, and the castle of Ibelin then passed to the next brother Baldwin. But Baldwin was already a lord of Romala, so basically thought, well, you know what, just take the castle, Balian, you have it. And I won't go into all the ways in which the film differed from reality, but it's interesting to talk a little bit about how the film portrays things, because it actually tracks, like, overall quite closely the events that happened.
Yeah.
In the sense that, like, the main characters mostly actually existed, which is not always given for Hollywood. And he really was the unfavored son of a knight father who and he really did lead the defense of Jerusalem, and he really did ultimately surrender the city. And the king at the time really did have leprosy. We'll come to that in a moment. And all these things were actually things that happened.
Okay.
He wasn't a blacksmith just like hanging around in Jerusalem. He wasn't like illegitimate.
He probably also wasn't as shredded as Orlando Bloom is in the movie. He's jacked, man.
In the movie, is he?
Yeah.
You know, I can't actually recall that bit. Okay. Is that right?
And we may have been watching for different reasons.
Interesting. We focus on different aspects. Yeah. That is interesting. And the worst part for me, though, is that Eva Green, it turns out, is not actually a Crusader princess. So, in the research for this bit, actually, it turns out, she's a French actress.
What?
She's like, she's not.
Eva Green.
Yeah, she's not a Crusader princess. So being a part of the court of the Holy Lands at the time as a knight meant that you were continually vying for power yourself, or you're having to pick sides between the various people who are vying for power. And so Balian found himself.
It's a real Game of Thrones.
Oh no, we can't bring it back now.
and Balian found himself caught up in this Game of Thrones quite a few times. And the big problem at the time was that King Baldwin IV, who we see in the film portrayed by Edward Norton, had leprosy, and he did actually have leprosy. And so there are a bunch of different factions.
Edward Norton did actually have leprosy.
He's a method actor, so he got it.
I still haven't seen the movie.
Have you not?
No, I haven't. And I refuse to watch anything based in historical fact.
Well, that explains a lot.
So there were all different people trying to be kind of regent for King Baldwin while he was off being ill. And one of the key struggles, it was basically just trying to live at the time, were between two aristocrats. So there was a guy called Raymond on the one hand. And
everybody loved him.
And he was the more popular figure. And then Guy de Lusignan, on the other hand, who is just a gloriously evil bad guy in the film. He's like almost camp, you know, by, I don't know who the actor is.
Brendan Gleeson, maybe?
Is it?
I can't remember, actually.
I think it's the other one, but he's a brilliant, he's a brilliant, brilliantly portrayed.
Hang on, did we just gloss over the fact that Everybody Loves Raymond is about the Crusades?
Yes, it is.
Wow, I really did not watch that show right.
And in real life, Balian actually was an advisor to Guy de Lusignan, whereas in the movie they're kind of arch enemies and nothing more complex than that. But so he backed Raymond originally, but then, you know, became an advisor to Guy later. So it's all very murky and grey. And the movie makes out that Balian was this very black and white figure from an ethical perspective, which it implies is like a really good thing because he holds to his principles. But actually, he was really just yet another knight caught up in the power struggle of the time. And the movie also makes out that he was too sensible to go along with Guy on his military campaign with the Templars and the Hospitallers. But actually, in reality, he was just a day behind the army because he was just held up. And he was a day behind trying to catch up when they were defeated at the Battle of Cresson by Saladin's son. And when he heard the news, he then scarpered back to Jerusalem.
Amazing.
So, and the movie then conflates that battle, Cresson, with a following one at Hattin, which was a much larger battle where the Crusader army, there's a very like long story I won't go into in detail, but the army basically allowed itself to be separated from its water source because Saladin's army got between them and the water. And so they then were just in the middle of the desert with no water, and it went quite badly from then on.
Suboptimal.
And so Saladin sort of systematically harassed their forces and then defeated them quite easily in the end. And this was basically the beginning of the end of the whole of the Kingdom of Jerusalem, really. And nearly every town and castle then successively fell to Saladin because the army, they defeated the whole army, or the bulk of the army. So Balian was then in a position where he had to kind of ask Saladin for permission to return through Saladin's lines to get to Jerusalem so he could escort his wife and children to Tripoli to escape.
Wow.
So his only desire at that point was just to kind of get his wife and kid and get out of there.
Yeah.
Wow.
And Saladin allowed it, and it provided that Balian, first of all, left the city straight away, and secondly, didn't raise arms against Saladin when he arrived in Jerusalem or thereafter. So, which Balian like completely went reneged on, as we'll see.
Oh, shocking.
So Balian then arrives in the Jerusalem. Understandably, the locals who, you know, the whole army had gone out to fight Saladin, right? So there's no army left in Jerusalem. Balian turns back up, having missed the battle because he was a day behind. And he comes back in. He's like, hi, anyone see my wife and kid? And then all the people are basically imploring him to stick around to help to defend the city. So, and the local patriarch,
and he's like, nah, man, I gotta go.
I made a deal.
No, it's slightly better than that. So the local patriarch then conveniently absolves Balian of this oath he's made to Saladin.
Wow.
Oh, okay, so you can just absolve oaths like that. Okay.
This is the whole thing. Yeah, exactly. Because God's on their side. God wills it, right?
Yes. And, okay, gotcha.
Then Balian found that there were literally only two other knights in the city, which is a very, very low number of knights.
Yeah, you want at least five or six.
You do, genuinely, at the very least. So so he created 60 new knights from the ranks of the soldiers who were in the city.
So much
rise
like just
a knight. Exactly. Rise a knight.
Is that from the movie?
Yes, and then my friends and I came up with, we made a musical version of it where the show-stopping song was called Rise a Knight, and it went like this. Rise a knight, rise a knight, rise a knight. And that was about as far as we got.
But it's the basis for a hit musical, I think.
I agree. And I will resume writing it as soon as we finish recording.
And when you rise a knight, do they automatically just inherit skills with defensive techniques and sword play?
No, they just become like a sort of fluffier, larger, tastier version of themselves.
on account of the yeast.
Indeed.
prove a knight. Wait a while.
You got to prove yourself.
Then
you rise.
You have to prove yourself in the proving drawer.
This
can
be
you
the key
rise.
Metaphor of the musical.
And then you earn some dough. Right?
Wow! Yeah. This thing writes itself.
It really does.
And what happens in the movie, for your benefit, Ant, is that the movie portrays Balian as just kind of assembling a whole bunch of peasants together, putting a weapon in their hand, and then making them all knights all as a wanna. But he didn't quite do that. He was actually just knighting the people who are already
poshos.
Soldiers. Yeah, they're already kind of like posho soldiers. But anyway, it still kind of happened. And then Saladin's army then arrives and just gets on with the professional job that they've been doing the whole time. Starts to knock down portions of the wall. They then do knock down a portion of the wall, but they can't then get into the city, which again is actually kind of what happens in the movie.
Yeah.
Because of the new knights, they hold them back.
Yeah, because there's like a 12-year-old holding a baguette who keeps them out.
Yeah, exactly. And then Balian does ride out to meet Saladin and parlays with him and reports that the defenders would, quote, rather kill each other and destroy the city than see it taken by force, unquote, which is not the message from the movie at all.
No.
But anyway, so they negotiate and they strike a deal that the city would be handed over peacefully to Saladin.
That could have happened if he just followed his original deal as well, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah. A complete waste
it's
of time.
Not clear why.
If anything, he's incurred more expenses. There's wall repair.
Yeah.
The night
he to,
upkeep.
He had to pay for the absolution from the priest.
Of course, yeah.
But I suppose he's got more leverage, right? You know, because he's proven they can make it painful to take. So anyway, and Saladin agrees that he will free 7,000 men who he's taken prisoner from the previous battles.
Yeah, okay.
And you will love this, Anna. So so Saladin says, okay, I'll free these 7,000 warriors, Crusader warriors, back to you, but in return for the Crusader warriors, you have to hand over 2 women or 10 children for each of the men.
What? So 70,000 children and women.
Or
14,000 women or
70,000 children.
Or some combination of that.
Or some combination.
Which would you rather have?
What?
I would hand over, I think if it was me, I would hand over 7,000 women and 35,000 children.
Nice.
And
That's fair.
Yeah. and then a subsequent negotiation takes place in which they arrive at the exact number to be handed over, and they do indeed hand people over. And then
They just handed over women and children.
Yeah. The thing to recognize this time is that these crusading knights were the kind of the modern equivalent of like a jet fighter pilot to train. You know, they spent their whole life training for combat,
and they're incredibly effective in combat.
Right, because the whole army was outflanked, so they never really got to fight.
So
you've got, like, they've all got decades of experience, that you need them for the subsequent campaigns and everything.
Yep.
So I think...
And women and children just weren't counted as people at the time, I guess.
Still aren't, arguably.
As I've said many times before, what use is an untrained child?
There wasn't even chimneys to sweep then.
Yeah, it's weird that you got that printed on your business cards. I feel like it doesn't come up in your line of work enough to justify you printing it.
They're just words I live by.
Yeah.
And then
that's why you train child soldiers.
And Balian then handed over the keys to the Tower of David, which is the citadel, on October the 2nd. And Saladin then allowed, much like the movie, an orderly march away from Jerusalem and prevented any kind of massacre taking place, when the Crusaders had previously captured Jerusalem and massacred everyone inside about 100 years before, or 90 years before. So Saladin was basically being quite a good egg, really.
Yeah, that is kind of one thing I remember from the movie, and also because this is what I studied at school, is like, as far as these things go, Saladin was actually pretty cool.
Had
he treated the Crusaders how they had treated his people earlier, he would have...
I think that's exactly right.
But he did profit
them.
Like 35,000 children and 7,000 women
The city of Jerusalem.
And the city of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's in his interest, I suppose, to let them go freely. So Balian then joined his wife and his children in Tripoli. And then, unlike in the movie, where Balian is then shown going back to France and living a life of quiet, humble peace.
Yeah.
What actually happened is he stayed in the Middle East and then took part in the Third Crusade 5 years later.
Classic.
Then continued to crusade all the way for the rest of his life, trying to conquer the Holy Land more and to regain Ibelin, which was under Saladin's control.
Yeah.
And so there you have it. That's the Balian of Ibelin in reality and in movie.
Okay, so this episode for 1187, I am going to take us on a trip to the modern day Middle East and the Indian subcontinent.
Mm.
And we're going to talk about some dynasties and dynastic change.
Ooh.
So in the year 1187, a chap, the hero of the tale, a guy called Muhammad of Gore, was a ruler of the region of the eponymous Gore, where he's of, which was in present day Afghanistan.
Oh.
He led a successful campaign against the Ghaznavid dynasty. So the Ghaznavids ruled for a couple of hundred years. So the Ghaznavids from about 977 to 1186 were this sort of Turkic dynasty that invaded northern India several times, but mostly based in Afghanistan. But he managed to overthrow them and establish his dynasty. So he captured the city of Multan in modern-day Pakistan, and this is part of a larger campaign of the Ghurids, the people of Gore, which was his dynasty, to extend their power over the territories that were under the control of the Ghaznavids. Mm. And this victory at Multan was significant in that it sort of took the base away from them, and it further established his supremacy in the region. And then, importantly, this actually paved the way for the creation of something far more important a few years later.
Which the Saturn V rocket.
The Saturn V rocket. It is, in fact...
That's amazing.
Yes.
Which famously took man to the moon for the first time.
Yeah.
As well as that, also the Delhi Sultanate.
But okay.
And like this, wow. just set the scene here in the sort of Indian subcontinent.
And the moon.
This goes, and the moon, to set the scene in the southern subcontinent of the moon. But there's just a long lineage of dynasties going back throughout the ages. And it starts off, the oldest recorded one is the Indus Valley civilization. So the Indus Valley...
Oh, you've really taken us back.
Yeah, really. Do you know what year do you think we're talking about here?
Like...
Indus Valley, 5,000 like BC, 10,000 BC,
3,300-ish BCE, and it's one of the first major urban civilizations. So this sort of area of territory has had just, you know, strata of civilization upon civilization upon them, and this is but the latest. But the Delhi Sultanate itself was quite significant. So they emerged in about 1206, and they lasted for about 300 years. But the reason why they're significant is because this was the first Muslim rule of the area.
Oh.
So prior to this, they were not in charge, and now they were. And it lasted until about the 16th century, and they sort of controlled the vast Indian subcontinent. And it established this crucial turning point in the sort of the South Asian history. And so this sultanate effectively ended the Hindu and Buddhist ruling dynastic areas and the sort of the class of peoples. And establish the Muslim sort of territories there.
I have a very important question.
Hmm.
Who plays Muhammad of Ghor in the movie?
I am applying for the role myself.
Okay. Because I'm having trouble picturing him. All I'm picturing is the shredded Orlando Bloom.
It's, Hugh Jackman.
Oh, okay.
Jackman. Shredded Hugh Jackman, obviously.
Great. No problems there.
So the Sultanate successfully resisted also the invasion of the Mongols, which was a massive stabilizing force. Yes, they did.
No. Mongols?
The Mongols, yes.
In India?
Well, they tried to, you know, in the Indian subcontinent.
The Mongols were a famously widespread empire.
Widespread, yeah.
I didn't know they were spread that.
They weren't like all nucleated in you know, like Tewkesbury or whatever.
Yes, Genghis Khan
They
of
never
Tewkesbury.
Left Watford. Yeah.
No. Why would you?
So, and they did this actually because what other people failed to do is they maintained a large standing army, which was actually sort of rare at the time. Yeah. A large standing army that you just kept up. It was like militias that formed as and when. And they also had strong fortifications, not just along the borders, but also in depth. So basically anywhere there's places of strategic importance, they had fortifications.
Sorry, you're talking about the Mongols now or Delhi Sultanate?
The Delhi Sultanate.
Okay, cool.
And they also had proactive campaigning to sort of keep the Mongols on the back foot so they couldn't sort of like store up logistics and stuff that would sort of disrupt them. So like some really interesting sort of military tactical bits there to actually, how do you maintain an empire or dynasty, which I am taking to heart. And so we will be invading Watford very soon to cut off their supplies. This also came with internal strife and conflict with some very intense periods of violence inside the dynasty, especially during the sort of conquest as expanding, people vying for power. There was religious tensions also between the predominantly Hindu population and the minority Muslim rulers. So it wasn't all fun and games for the Delhi Sultanate.
I mean, nor has it been in the subsequent centuries.
Yeah, I mean, it does.
Haven't really solved that one.
It does get a bit worse, unfortunately, before it gets better. But the Delhi Sultanate facilitated just a great deal of cultural and religious change. They brought along Persian influences and sort of spread them, and Persian became the official language of the courts. And also, interestingly, this is where Damascus steel first was made and invented. If you have heard of Damascus steel, it is a specific type of forming of steel where you...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com. Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Fold it over each other again and again and beat it down, and it creates these beautiful, beautiful patterns.
And so, it didn't come from Damascus?
Well, Damascus steel is a bit of a misnomer. It's kind of, you know, where did it actually come from? But we think it's from here, and it's okay. Just a misnomer.
Oh, wow.
Damascus steel.
Is that like Valyrian steel?
It is exactly like Valyrian. It is the only thing you can slay White Walkers with, and they invented it there. So one of the significant pieces that is still standing from this time is the sort of the fusion of Islamic and Hindu architectural styles, which became predominant there. And this led to the creation of the Qutb Minar, which is in Delhi, so spelled Qutb space M-I-N-A-R.
You can see that with a telescope from Earth, can't you? You can see it on night on the moon.
Yeah, you can see it if you're in Delhi. You can just look at it and it's right there.
Yeah.
I didn't go to the moon for my research to see, but
wow, I thought you cared about the podcast.
But it is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's a beautiful tall tower, effectively, is what it is, and it's just a prime example of the architecture of the time and the feats and the complexity of which they're able to build. So they're really, really interesting stuff. They also laid the foundation for the emergence of the Mughal Empire that would come after them, and that had a dramatic impact on the subcontinent, consolidating power and sort of making it more official and joined up, and shaped culture, arts, and just like administrative prowess of the region as well, which then was subsequently taken over by the British Raj.
There they come.
Yes. So the Delhi Sultanate.
Talk about White Walkers.
Yeah, I know. Funny they had more Damascus steel.
Nice.
That's good, right? That's what you people are.
So they're the first major Muslim power, political power in the in sort of Indian subcontinent, ruling from about 1206. However, they were in decline with internal divisions, rebellion, and the invasion of the people from Timur, so T-I-M-U-R, in 1398, where there was a descendant of the Timurid princes and sort of Genghis Khan himself, and they defeated the last sultan of Delhi and then took over, and then this sort of spawned the next age, this guy called Babur. And that marks the end of the Delhi Sultanate and beginning of the Mughal Empire in India, and then they dominated the whole place. Lots of rich architectural grandeur, famous structures like the Taj Mahal were built then, and the Red Fort being constructed this time. And then,
I mean, we're like hundreds of years past 1187
right? Yeah, we are quite a long way from where we started, okay. Toto. So, you know, just hold on. But yeah, and then the British Raj in 1858, which, you know, they governed from that stage. Rather aggressively. So there you go. That is the sort of talk about the Delhi Sultanate and the takeover by Muhammad of Gore and the Ghaznavid dynasty's fall from grace.
Amazing.
That's really interesting. I actually have learned a lot about Indian history during this podcast.
Good.
In a way that, I mean, I can now slightly see how things connect together.
Yes.
It's
just a bunch of history that I've never really studied before.
Yeah.
I didn't really know much about, and just even understanding that dozens and dozens of dynasties that sort of span this area, all vying for power, that, and a lot of them that you might not have heard of, the Pala Emperor, the Palvala, the Vatikata Empire, etc., the Gupta Empire.
Well, they're big ones,
really big ones. For sure.
How many are you going to mention?
I can name all of them. I think I've got about two dozen here that I can keep going, and if you really want me to.
There are really cool like videos or animations that show the territory over time, like a time lapse,
and changing,
you see
just the
like some people control all of India, some people have just a corner of it, and it changes. And
it's just a fascinating like melting pot of culture, architecture, religion, all coming together and changing and morphing through time. So it's like just a very rich, dense sort of strata of architectural styles and interesting bits of history.
God, go. History
in a history podcast.
Man. Love it.
Who would have
God save
thought?
The Queen, man.
Oh. Like Ant, I'm also today talking about a place that I don't know very much about. And it's a whole new language family of words to mispronounce, which is exciting. Yes, I'm talking about Oklahoma. No, Japan.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I think this is my first time talking about Japan. I can't remember if any of us have ever talked about it, which is crazy because it has an incredibly long and interesting history.
I fear Japanese history and culture because it's for several reasons in the context of something I feel confident enough to talk about on a podcast, like because it's just so distinct from like European-centric culture, right? Yeah. And it's its own thing. There's lots of complicated words that I worry about mispronouncing. I've basically always avoided it for that reason.
Great. Well, I'm going to be bold. And I
maybe I'll do it in future. We're doing this
please
now.
Also because you lost your master and now you're a wandering ronin and no longer a sort of a noble samurai, right?
Exactly right. That's right. I have, in addition to those factors I mentioned earlier, perhaps the principal reason I should have mentioned was that, of course, I've lost my master having been a samurai.
And Tom Cruise played you in that movie.
Tom Cruise, of course, played me in the movie and now I'm a mere ronin.
Well,
sorry, back to
history. Yeah,
great. So,
Japan.
That's how we say it. I'm going to talk a little bit about an important war that was actually kind of a turning point in Japanese history, and then a story of some characters that kind of came out of that war that I found really fascinating. And so that is what I'm going to talk about. And now here I go. I'm going to talk about it now.
Introduction complete.
So I want to talk, first of all, about the Genpei War. And this is a power struggle between two really powerful samurai clans, the Taira and the Minamoto. And the Taira had been historically closer to the emperor at this time, but they had been tussling with the Minamoto for decades for influence and power. And it finally comes to a head in 1180. So in that year, the ruling emperor died, and I believe his son, it may have been a grandson, but I think it was his son, named Antoku, ascends to the throne, the chrysanthemum throne, which is the throne of Japan, imperial Japan. Antoku.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Cool, I like him.
I'm sure he went by Ant.
Yep.
But he was a baby. He was 1 year old. So much like you.
So the chrysanthemum, like...
Cradle. Yeah. Yeah. So there is a baby on the throne. His mother is a Taira, and his grandfather is the leader of the Taira, and he rules in his place.
Okay, yeah.
Not officially as regent, but like definitely is the power behind the throne. Yeah. And this angers some people.
Let the baby rule.
As we've all said, let the baby rule. Except, Will, this is another case where your motto comes in handy.
Is the baby trained?
He is not trained.
Not interested.
Yeah, exactly. So a call goes out to the Minamoto asking for their aid in overthrowing the Taira and getting this... a baby emperor off the throne.
Yeah.
And that is exactly what happened. The Minamoto are absolutely in. They've been waiting to really bring this thing to a head. And very quickly, it becomes a full-scale war between these two sides. And it goes back and forth for 5 years, culminating in the decisive Battle of Dannoura in 1185, which is one of the most famous naval battles in Japanese history.
I don't associate naval warfare with Japanese history. I don't know why. I mean, obviously, it's
I think because historically, because they weren't exploring in the way that we think of the Portuguese or the Spanish and associate them with seafaring. But yeah, I think
makes sense. Series of islands, right?
Midway.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Well, then famously they had a big naval presence.
Regretted that one
in one of the big wars. But in this one in 1185, it's a naval battle. And the tides played a powerful role, as
cruel
they
mistress.
Often do. Cruel mistress. The Taira were more experienced sailors in general, and the tides at first gave them the advantage. But
6 hours later,
it switched. I mean, basically.
It was a real back and forth.
Yeah. And the Minamoto advantage was considerably enhanced by the defection of Taguchi, who was a warrior, a really famous Taira warrior who went over to the Minamoto side in the middle of the action. Maybe hopped off a boat and swam to the other side. Yeah. But unclear, but that really turned the tide, you may say, in addition to the tide being turned by the moon. It's a really moon-heavy episode.
It is, actually. The moon does feature quite a lot here.
We love the moon. So, sadly...
I think we should steer away from politics, to be honest, actually.
Emperor Antoku, who at this point is a child, he was there at the battle and he was drowned along with many, many others. And the Taira... I don't know if I'm saying that right at all, but so I apologize. But they lose the battle and the war. The Minamoto win, and it's a really big turning point in history because it leads to the Shogun era. Yeah.
What is this?
The Shogun era is essentially a series of military dictatorships. The emperor,
right?
Yeah, the Shogunate, yeah. So the emperor still existed, but for about 650 years,
oh, wow.
The real power behind the throne was the Shoguns, who are these military dictators.
So Taira, yeah?
Minamoto.
Oh, Minamoto, won. So Taira Banks out.
Taira's out.
Yeah.
She didn't, she's Minamoto. Not Japan's next top shogun. the Minamoto win. And Minamoto no Yoritomo becomes the first shogun. And yeah, like I said, the shogunate era, why do I keep saying era? The shogunate era lasted for 650 years until the Meiji Restoration. Anyway.
Wow.
So it's a pretty consequential war. It really changes the face of Japan and who's the power behind the throne. But in the second half of my bit here, there's a side story that I also really loved because it's pretty emblematic of this, I think, maybe overly romanticized samurai lifestyle. Yeah. But to be fair, it was also romanticized in the era. So the people I'm about to talk about became the stuff of legends and are actually quite famous pop culture figures, or cultural figures, I guess. So there was an old man named Fujiwara no Hirihara who ruled northern Fujiwara. And this,
of course.
Of course.
Thank you for setting that.
Yes.
Apart from southern or central Fujiwara.
We all obviously know exactly where northern Fujiwara is.
Yep, Japan.
It is to the north of southern Fujiwara. it's kind of in the northeast of Japan, and it was a little independent of the central government. He ruled with a great deal of autonomy. And before the war kicked off, he had offered to shelter one of the Minamoto. So he, even though he was independent, he kind of drew a line in the sand by sheltering a Minamoto who at that
Sorry,
point...
Sorry, and a Minamoto is what?
Remember the two sides of the battle were the Taira and the Minamoto.
Got it.
So this is before the war, the Tairas are in power, but Fujiwara is sheltering a Minamoto.
Okay. There will be a quiz.
I've tried to reduce the number of proper nouns as much as possible, but there are going to be some.
Also, I feel bad about the Fujiwara comment because there's probably like 8 million people live there or something today.
Oh,
like,
it is a massive
so
amount
ignorant.
Of territory.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, you've set your own progress with Japanese history back like 6 or 7 episodes. Anyway, so this guy, Fujiwara, is sheltering a Minamoto son whose name is Yoshitsune.
Ah.
And we will just be calling him Yoshi. Because I am already so self-conscious about all of the pronunciation.
Oh, yeah, you've got it all wrong.
So Yoshi eventually leaves the sanctuary of Fujiwara to join his brother, who is leading the Minamoto war effort. So the Minamoto brothers are now out of their sanctuary, and they're fighting the Taira, and they're winning the battle. I'm acting it out with my hands so that Will can understand.
Good. Yeah, it's good.
Do you understand what's going on with my hands? The Minamoto win the war, as we've talked about, and the older brother, Yoritomo, becomes the first shogun, as I've just mentioned. But at a certain point, Yoshi, despite having fought the war alongside his brother, now that his brother is in power, decides that he doesn't want to support him. He tries to overthrow him.
Okay.
It does not go well. And so Yoshi flees back to Fujiwara, to his sanctuary with this old man, as a sort of hoping that he'll be protected from his now very powerful and angry brother. In 1187, the old man dies, but commands his son to keep offering protection to Yoshi. Now, what has history taught us? Happened next.
Basically, no one ever follows any will ever.
Yeah.
Was he absolved from this oath?
Yeah. So the son absolves himself from the deathbed promise he made to his father.
Brilliant.
Gives up Yoshi almost immediately. Mm. Says to the older brother, the shogun, I have your brother. He's here. Come get him. And the shogun does come, and Yoshi is betrayed, and he knows that he's lost. And as the brother, the first shogun, and his troops close in around this castle, Yoshi decides that he would rather commit seppuku than surrender.
Grim. Yeah.
And as a quick side note, the first recorded act of seppuku, which is, if you don't know, the kind of ritualistic suicide that samurai often undertook, the first recorded act happened just a few years earlier.
Oh, so right.
Either in 1170 or 1180, also by a member of the Minamoto clan.
So he wasn't even sure this trend was going to catch on.
Yeah, so he was an early adopter. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's not really a ritual then, is it? If it's just like something someone did 3 years ago.
Yeah, I think
I'm
going to
try this new thing out. It's like a restaurant, you know?
Establishing the ritual, right? Someone's got to start the trend.
Grim.
Someone was the first person to wear Crocs.
This is just like that.
Just like that. I don't know why
that's... actually modern day ritualistic seppuku.
You might as well be committing social seppuku.
Yeah. I don't know why that's the first trend I thought of. Anyway, so Yoshi has gone into the castle to commit seppuku rather than surrender.
Bowser's.
And his, yes, castle. Into Bowser's castle. We might be veering into offensive things now. So Yoshi's retainer, his sort of manservant, is a man named Benkei, who is a famous warrior monk, and he's actually fascinating and worthy of his own segment, but I won't get into all of that now. But apparently he was 2 meters tall, and he armed himself with 7 weapons at all time, and was on a quest to take 1,000 swords from samurai warriors who he believed were arrogant and unworthy, which I think is a pretty dope quest.
That is pretty cool.
Nice. Yeah. So this guy, you have to imagine, like, the legend around this guy is huge already in his life. And I mention him here because when it became clear that Yoshi had been betrayed and was going to be captured by his brother, Benkei stood guard on the bridge of the castle to give Yoshi enough time to prepare for the rite of seppuku. And it's said that the soldiers were too afraid to cross the bridge because Benkei was there. Some of the soldiers attempted it, but he killed 300 of them.
Mm, definitely.
You know?
Also, he was 2 meters tall.
He's 2 meters
tall.
A
meter wasn't invented at the time.
Okay, well, yeah, he was 2 imperial Japanese meters tall.
Okay, yeah.
And then so the soldiers, seeing that this was they couldn't win, switched to arrows, and they shot many, many, many arrows at him. And when they finally gained the courage to cross the bridge to see if he was dead, he was indeed dead, but was still standing upright. And this is now known as the standing death of Benkei.
That's pretty cool. But also, you think they'd switch to arrows like 200 soldiers prior to that?
Yeah. I think tactically some mistakes were made.
Keep going single file, one at a time, everyone.
Maybe it was a very narrow bridge.
Give him enough time for a water break as well.
Well, he had 7 weapons, so he was just like constantly gathering different things off
his back. Standing death of Benkei.
That's standing death of Benkei, which is cool.
That's very cool.
And then he becomes this kind of revered figure. There's a statue of him. Anyway, just to close it out, the guy who had betrayed Yoshi to his brother takes Yoshi's head, preserves it in a jar of sake, and sends it to the brother, the shogun, as a way to be like, hey, remember when I ignored my father's dying wish to protect this guy and instead I betrayed him for you? Here's his head. You're welcome. But Yoritomo, the shogun, was not appeased and he killed the guy anyway, destroyed the whole Fujiwara domain. So all of it was in vain.
That is...
Golly gosh.
Yeah. Great choices all around. That is just a little bit about what was happening in Japan in the 1180s and the kind of beginning of this really interesting phase of Japanese history.
People are the worst, aren't they?
Yeah, people are bad.
Wherever you go in the world, whichever historical period you look at, everyone's lying and chopping each other up.
I mean, as I was doing that research, I remembered that isn't even the first time that this exact scenario of presenting somebody the head of somebody you've killed for them only for the receiver of the head to say, thanks, not enough. I've talked about that exact scenario. Yeah, on
that happened to you this morning, didn't it?
That happened to me this morning. I cannot tell you how hard it is to get rid of a head.
They're never happy.
No one will take them. So anyway, I hope I've done a little bit of justice to that period of history. And if you liked it, I will do more Japan. And if I said anything wrong, I apologize. And I will stick to America.
More, please.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us. That's everything you'd ever need to know about the year 1187 and a few decades and centuries before and after, as is our custom.
Yep. I'm very happy with how this has gone.
Yeah. Should we do a live debrief?
Yeah. I'll rate my segment 5.
Yeah.
Out of 5. Anyway, now is all that's left to do.
Yes.
Now is all that's left to do. Now is all that's left to do is get us the next year for
exactly.
next time.
Exactly
please,
right,
William.
Now is get us the next year.
Good. This outro is going really normally. Everything's
so
going
normal.
Great. So before I do ask the random number generator to select a year for us next time, just a reminder that if you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/randomlyhistory, where you can become a board member and select a year for yourself. For us to cover for you.
Did I say I was talking to one of our esteemed and illustrious board members the other day, and I reminded him that he had yet to choose a year, and he chose the year 2043.
That's helpful.
That's outside the range.
And he would like to predict the future. And I told him that he could do that if he tripled the amount of money that he is currently paying us.
We are in a lot of debt. So we'd probably do it as well.
Yeah, that's true.
Probably would. Okay, so I'll just fire up the random number generator. And the year for next time is 1995.
What?
Yes! Yes!
Can I just like do one of my memories?
Yes, that is that's the first year that we've been alive for, right?
Yes, it is.
We did 85, which famously some of us may have been in utero, but have memories.
I was 11.
Is that right?
We were all 11 years old.
I think this is the first one we've done that we've have been alive.
Should we do something on the Patreon where we just describe something that happened to us when we were 11? I think it could be very cathartic.
We weren't 11,
mate.
We were 9.
We were 9?
Yeah.
Did I do maths bad?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or either that or you're 2 years older than you've been telling me this whole time.
Time is a flat circle.
Yeah. I'm so excited. I'm going to just read the Saddle Club or a Babysitter's Club book. Or maybe, oh my God, maybe I'll see if I can find a journal that I kept in fourth grade.
Let's just read to us
and
for 10 minutes.
Just read to you about the boys that I had a crush on back
when
then.
When I started smoking. And
Seth Freeman, if you're listening.
Seth Freeman.
Tyler Newton, too. Anyway.
Okay. Anyway, okay, we should finish.
I have several more names. Hold on.
Join us next time to learn more about Seth Newton and Tyler. Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.